Hello, everyone. This is Bonfire Madigan. We're not crazy. The system is. Tune into the Radical Mental Health Show, hosted by the Freedom Center, Wednesday nights, 6 to 7 p.m. on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM.
This is the Radical Mental Health Show on Valley Free Radio. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Will Hall. And tonight we're doing a special show on violence and madness, which has really been in the news a lot lately. And on the phone, we have Robert Whitaker, who's going to be joining us in a few minutes. Robert Whitaker is the author of the amazing book, Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill. But first, I just want to introduce the show and talk a little bit about the Freedom Center. Freedom Center is a mental health advocacy, support, and activism group set up, I think it was 5.5 years ago, by people who've been diagnosed and labeled with different mental health labels like schizophrenia, bipolar, depression, borderline. And we came together and started a group because we really were looking for alternatives to the mainstream approaches to mental health, including alternatives to medication, and also working for human rights issues, protecting people's rights, helping people with legal advocacy. And you can check out our work on the web at freedom-center.org. We offer a number of different projects and programs and things that we're up to, including our Monday night free yoga class, which is 7 o'clock on Monday nights in downtown Northampton. And that's free beginner's yoga, taught by a wonderful certified yoga teacher who also has an experience as a body worker and student of body-mind centering. So it's a really innovative and really fun yoga class you can come and check out. And then also on Mondays at 4:30, we have a free acupuncture clinic, which has been going for about a year now. And that's offered by Barbara Weinberg, who's a licensed acupuncturist, and it's at 43 Center Street in downtown Northampton. Free acupuncture every Monday at 4:30. And you can find out more about the Freedom Center. Just check out our website, freedom-center.org. I want to get right into the show tonight. There's a lot to talk about. It's a really important and urgent issue. It's been in the news recently. And my guest is Robert Whitaker. Robert Whitaker is a Pulitzer-nominated journalist. He is the author of a number of books, including Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill. He's also the author of The Map, The Mapmaker's Wife, I think it's called. And he's been a journalist for the Boston Globe and has been an outspoken critic investigative force in looking into medical ethics issues, human experimentation, pharmaceutical company corruption, and the history of madness and mental health in the United States. So I am very pleased to introduce Robert Whitaker to the show. Let me see if I can get him on here. Bob, can you hear us?
I can.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to invite you to talk about the issue of violence and madness, or violence and psychosis. As we all know, there was a very tragic murder of a prominent psychiatrist, Wayne Fenton. This happened, I guess, about a month ago. He was killed by one of his young therapy clients. He was seeing him on an outpatient basis, and we don't know exactly the details. No one was of course, there, but he was killed by his client. And this, you know, raised immediate questions. There's been a real debate in the media about this, and a lot of people calling for more force, drugging, and more use of confinement in hospitals around people who are presumed to be dangerous, who have a history of violence, and have a diagnosis of psychosis or mental illness. And the presumption that these things are linked is one of the things that we're going to be looking at tonight. So welcome, Bob Whitaker.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what are your thoughts? I don't know. I know it's a big issue, but what are your thoughts of this? The thing that struck me most was how there are a number of different studies, I guess, which say different things about whether people who are labeled psychotic are actually more dangerous or more violent than the general population.
Right. I mean, I have to confess, this is a sort of a confusing topic. I mean, for me personally, to sort of sort out my own thoughts on it. But, let me start this way and go to this question of, you know, are people so labeled more likely to commit violence, that sort of thing? And second, and I think this is the part that really needs to be thought about, does this paradigm of care that we have, this drug-based paradigm of care, does it really make people less violent or more violent? And let's sort of start with the second question, because that's one actually I looked at when I was writing Mad in America. And what you find is, you know, like so many things in this field, it's not all that well studied. But first of all, what you find is that before the advent of the psychiatric drug revolution, and before the advent of antipsychotics, I'm talking about Thorazine and Haldol in the 1950s, there were studies of how often people who were discharged from mental hospitals committed felony crimes after discharge. And what they found, so, and generally that's, you know, that's not just violence, but certainly violence is in that category, and rearrest rates, and arrest rates for people discharged. And what they found is that they were basically equivalent to the background rate for the general population as a whole. Okay, so no more likely to be arrested than people of the same age, et cetera.
So this is before the introduction of the psychiatric drugs.
Mm-hmm. However, afterwards, and these were studies done in the 60s and 70s, they found actually that the rearrest rates for mental patients, in fact, were elevated above the background rate. And I think the rate might be adjusted for income as well. I'm not positive about that. But the point is, it seems like there's a shift after we start into this drug-based form of care. And all of a sudden, it seems like there's actually a greater propensity to violence, okay? And that's the first sort of study we need to look at. Now, the second study that came out, and this is looking at particular use of antipsychotics like Haldol and Thorazine, the classic standard antipsychotics, was what they found is that patients placed on these drugs often experience akathisia, I mean, real regularly, in fact, with Haldol and some of the others, like 75%. Now, akathisia is this incredibly internal agitation. I mean, people talk about it as sort of a torment, and they pace, and they want to sit down at the same time, and they talk about just this, they just can't be at peace.
Yeah, I can actually personally testify to that, because I've had akathisia a number of times when I was on drugs, and it's kind of like you're burning up on the inside, and you're just like ready to explode. At the same time, you're totally tied up and stuck. And it's this incredible agitation, and it was extremely uncomfortable, just a horrifying experience.
And people talk about how, you know, studies have found like 75% of people placed on at least the standard antipsychotics experience that. So now you have a drug-related experience that's very unpleasant, and then what happened is studies tied that to violence, okay? For example, there was one study that found that 50% of all fights on a psychiatric ward could be tied to akathisia, 50%.
So that's a drug side effect. So 50%
exactly.
Of the violence is tied to a drug side effect.
Right. And then second of all, they also tied it to these horrific, there was a lot of anecdotal cases where they tied it to horrific murders. And when they interviewed the people afterwards, they talked about, well, why'd you do this? And they just talked about how they were feeling they were being tortured by the drugs, and they would say things, I wanted to kill basically someone from society who was doing this to me, and they just had this rage build up in relationship in response to the drugs and in response to the akathisia.
Now, is this, Bob, is this related to the side effect? Because I think akathisia is also a side effect of some of the antidepressants, right?
Yes, you can get akathisia with antidepressants as well, the SSRIs. And yes, so you have this sense. And we do know, for example, the SSRIs, when you go on them, some people have suicidal and in essence, homicidal feelings in response to that.
And you're talking...
And by the way, suicide and homicide, in those two responses, those sort of violent responses in connection with, akathisia, are really part of the same spectrum of response, right?
It's like an explosive kind of violent reaction.
Yeah, and sometimes it's turned inwards because people say, I have to get out of this state. And sometimes that rage is turned outward.
And when you say SSRIs, you're talking about Paxil, Zoloft, Prozac.
Yeah, exactly. So by the 19, I think it's the late 80s, early 1990s, you see a guy by the name of Theodore Van Putten, I think that was his name, Van Patten, excuse me, out in UCLA, saying this is a behavioral toxicity associated with the drugs. Okay, so we have a paradigm of care, and more notable, I think, with the antipsychotics, but it also shows up in the trials with the SSRIs, the antidepressants, that the drugs, when you go on them, can stir this physiological response, feeling, akathisia, and that, in turn, is tied to violence.
And
okay?
So, at least,
before we decide what we as a society should be doing, like legally with people, we have to recognize that,
right? We have to acknowledge that, exactly. And this is also something that's been talked about in terms of the that some of the teen high school shootings, and there's evidence like the Andrea Yates murder of her children, that these were tied to exactly what you're talking about, drug side effects. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And let's just really flesh out this drug side effect thing, because this is something that's never talked about in the media. So you have one moment when that occurs, right? You go on the drugs, you experience akathisia. Now, here's the irony of this. The second of all, you can also experience akathisia when you go abruptly off the drugs. It seems maybe contradictory or paradoxical, but what happened is you go on the drugs, your brain actually tries to compensate for what the drugs are doing to your brain, like say with the antipsychotics blocking dopamine, and then you come off, and often when you come out, you come off abruptly, you get up a flare-up of akathisia again. And I think Andrea Yates was both being put on new drugs and yanked off Haldol, so she was being yanked in all sorts of different directions. So, paradoxically, you'll read in the newspapers, this person was off their drugs. They just got off their drugs. And so people say, that means they need to be on their drugs. But they're not digging down and understanding that, in fact, the violence that they may do as they go off the drugs may be drug-related.
So is it similar to like a recreational drug or even like alcohol or tobacco, that you have a withdrawal effect and then there's an agitation, or the withdrawal effect is related to the chemical changes that have to go on with abruptly discontinuing something that your brain gets adjusted to?
Yeah, I mean, it is a withdrawal effect. So with the antipsychotics, I mean, the physiology is even somewhat known. What happens with the antipsychotics, let's say you're on Haldol, Haldol blocks dopamine. In response, your brain, in fact, increases the number of dopamine receptors it has in the brain. And then all of a sudden, when you withdraw that Haldol or withdraw one of those other antipsychotics, in essence, your brain is in an abnormal state because it's now got too many dopamine receptors, and that becomes a type of withdrawal, behavior, I guess is the way to put it, because you've given them a drug that changes the brain, then you've taken away the drug, and they're in this unusual state. It is a withdrawal syndrome. And by the way, this sort of behavioral deterioration upon withdrawal of antipsychotics is well known. I mean, it's been well studied. Relapses are real, real common when you abruptly withdraw these drugs. So it is a withdrawal phenomenon. It certainly can happen with Paxil and some of the antidepressants as well. So we need to be cognizant of that when we talk about this as well. So, for example, the murder you were talking about when you introduced this, this topic, was the murder of Wayne Fenton, right? In I guess it's Washington D.C. Well, I don't know what happened there, but it would be interesting. One of the stories I read, they said, Mr. Fenton was talking about the need for this patient to go back on the drugs, and perhaps even he might need an injection. Well, if you've been through that, and you experience these drugs as a form of torture, you could see why maybe that would stir rage. And by the way, in the 1970s, the Soviet Union used these drugs actually to torture dissidents. So as we discuss this problem of violence and madness, we need to talk about, well, because the knee-jerk response is, oh, they need to be drugged. But we need to flesh out what role do the drugs play in stirring the violence. And that's never talked about in the media. And as we flesh this out, maybe in this show, Will, there's one other problem here. These drugs also, and the antidepressants do this as well, the antipsychotics do it much more profoundly, is they block activity in the frontal lobes of the brain. This is the part of the brain that really makes us human, and it's also the part of the brain where we monitor our actions. So let's say I have an impulse all of a sudden to do harm to somebody, and I'm not on drugs, right? And I have this impulse, I don't know, to slug somebody or whatever. Hopefully my frontal lobes are going to kick in and go, well, that's not a good thing to do. That's not an ethical thing to do. And I can block that sort of emotional response, and I cannot act upon it. But if we have drugs that, A, are causing this inner rage, and at the same time knocking out some of the frontal lobe activity that allows us to monitor our actions and that lets us know right and wrong, well, then you really got a problem. And personally, I think that's why the drugs are so often associated with violence, is A, you have something that can cause rage and this feeling of incredible inner agitation, and B, at the same time, you're taking away part of the function that allows us to know right and wrong. So that's the story about drugs that needs to be talked about.
Yeah, this is really not recognized by the profession. The prevailing myth is, of course, that the medications are correcting some kind of imbalance, like giving insulin to a diabetic, and that you're restoring the brain to its proper functioning, which is actually not the situation. I mean, there's a common sense kind of response here that needs to just say, well, look, these are drugs. They change brain chemistry just like street drugs do, and there are going to be implications to that. There are going to be results from that. And somehow, I think the psychiatric establishment there's been a mystification that's gone on about what exactly the chemistry and what exactly the action of the drugs is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is this story that these are chemical imbalancers. They balance what is an abnormal chemistry in the brain. That's not true at all. That hypothesis goes back to the 1960s, let's say with schizophrenia, that schizophrenia is caused by too much dopamine in the brain. The drugs block dopamine, and therefore, like insulin for diabetes, they help bring it back into balance. Researchers investigated that hypothesis, and they found it not to be true. They found that people diagnosed with schizophrenia prior to medication, there was no abnormally high levels of dopamine. And in 1992, you can read guys who investigated saying that hypothesis is no longer credible. They investigated it, found it not to be true. However, and this is what you're talking about, they did find that the drugs perturb that normal brain chemistry. In other words, do antipsychotics block dopamine? Absolutely. Do they do it profoundly? Absolutely. Does the brain change in response to that blockage of dopamine? Absolutely. This is all well known. And in fact, in 1996, Stephen Hyman, who's the former director of NIMH, wrote a paper called something like A Paradigm for Understanding Psychotropic Drug Action. And, Will, he makes the same point that you make. He says that we have illegal drugs that perturb neurotransmitters. The brain tries to compensate for that and goes through some changes. And we consider those often to be harmful. He says, but the same thing is happening with that same paradigm holds true for the legal drugs, antidepressants and antipsychotics. It just so happens that change, he says, produces, quote, a therapeutic response. Well, he's labeling it therapeutic there, but let's peel away that word of efficacy there, and it means that we have this common paradigm for understanding how drugs work on the brain, whether they're illegal or legal. And what they do is they perturb neurotransmitters in the brain. Again, perturb is Hyman's word. And by the way, Hyman concludes that in response to this perturbation, the brain undergoes a set of compensatory adaptations, and by the time it's done, it's operating, his words, in a manner that is both qualitatively and quantitatively different than normal. In other words, these are chemical imbalancers, not chemical balancers. And again, we should be honest about that science when we start talking about you know, this question of violence and whether people should be forcibly drugged.
Absolutely. And if you're just tuning in, this is Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LPFM. This is the Radical Mental Health Show. We are talking with Robert Whitaker, who is author of Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill. And Bob, you have a website, madinamerica.com, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. So we're talking about the issue of violence and people labeled mentally ill. And I guess maybe we should back up. There's kind of two directions that I want to go in. One is, you know, where did these drugs come from? Because we know that they are useful in some extent, to some extent, in some context. And so there is a kind of a therapeutic quality to them in that sense, because they do shut down, numb, control, tranquilize people. In fact, the neuroleptics are also used in veterinary medicine for tranquilizing animals. And my understanding is that the innovation of Thorazine and the neuroleptic so-called antipsychotic drugs was that they calmed people down without putting them to sleep. Is that correct?
Yes. And, you know, if you conceive of the drugs in that manner, that they affect some sort of change, whether they're sort of as in a tonic manner, you know, that they're sedatives, that they can be calming in certain senses, then you can understand a use for them, like in certain situations, right? And because you're seeing them as, like I said, having a sedative property or whatever, or a numbing property. Maybe sometimes you do need to numb people out, their feelings, and that can be therapeutic, or helping people go to sleep.
I know sometimes I want to numb myself out or go to sleep.
Absolutely.
I have friends who use the anticonvulsant medication or antipsychotic medication as a way of kind of putting the brakes on when they're going into, you know, sleepless days and days without sleep, or they can feel themselves going into a state. And I think the real question is whether you're using the drugs honestly, understanding how they work and the risks, or whether you're buying into this myth of, oh, we're correcting chemical imbalances because we have to take the drugs.
That's exactly the point. And going back to what you're making, going back to the origin of these drugs, they could have a purpose, they can have a purpose, but in order to use them wisely and successfully, I guess, is you have to be honest about what they do. And if you go back to Thorazine and that class of drugs, they were developed for use in anesthesia because they could numb the nervous system. They were understood to be agents that numb the nervous system without, as you said, making people go to sleep. So people thought they might have use in surgery. And then what happened is some people noticed that, some doctors noticed, surgeons noticed, that when they gave these drugs to their patients, I'm talking about Thorazine, they seemed not to care about the world. They seemed emotionally indifferent to the world. Well, that was seen as maybe good for psychiatric patients. That was thought that maybe this would make it easier to manage mental hospitals. And let's just talk about that. So let's say we have a drug that, A, can calm people, B, can sort of make them a bit lethargic, and C, can make them less emotionally interested in their environment. Well, there may be a time that that's a good thing, that maybe you have someone in a real manic state or whatever, and you need this sort of to quiet them down and stop the whatever sort of internal, you know, thing is going on. Okay, fine, do it, use it, makes perfect sense. But you're not balancing any brain chemistry. You're just using it as a tonic, so to speak, as a nerve numbing agent. And that's what we need to do. Is we need to talk honestly about these drugs.
And once we do that, we can really recognize the risks, which are really, you know, dramatically increased when they're used long term, which is the paradigm of, like, okay, it's kind of like you've got Down syndrome. I mean, this is a genetic thing, it's a brain disorder, it's a lifelong thing, and your brain chemistry doesn't function right, you got to take the drugs forever. And that's really when the brain damaging aspect of the drugs come in, isn't that right?
Absolutely. Well, you can use drugs for an acute episode of something, right? And help people recover from that acute episode, whatever the drugs might be. By the way, for example, if you take someone in a psychotic episode, you give them a benzodiazepine, that's just as that will help that person break the psychosis just as well as the antipsychotic.
And you're talking about Valium. Or,
exactly.
In fact, that's often one of the things that we found at the Freedom Center, is that lack of sleep, that usually when people are in a psychotic state, or they're in some kind of wild state, they're under extreme stress and they haven't gotten good sleep. And I'm not saying that's always the case, but if you can get someone to go to sleep, and maybe it's a benzodiazepine like Valium, maybe if their body is responsive to it, it's an herbal sleep aid or a homeopathic sleep aid, whatever it is, if you can get the person to sleep, that will help dramatically to, you know, get them back into a less stressed out state where their head is a little bit clearer.
You know, no question. And then, by the way, if you go back to the turn of the century, European psychiatrists, when they talked about what should be the first response to someone who's in a psychotic episode, you know what they said? Get them to sleep.
Right. Well,
that's the first thing. Get them to sleep.
That's
and if you
what
can
we
restore
say.
The wake-sleep cycle, you know, you're going to be able to basically relieve the psychosis, you know, in many, many people.
And I think this is the direction that the research should be going, is, you know, things like, well, what is the relationship between psychotic states and sleep, and how helpful can we be if we can help provide people with good sleep, and what is it that interferes with good sleep? So I'm really interested in the historical aspect of this, and I know that one of the things that drives, you know, this word, whenever we hear this word psychosis, people just, you know, they just tense up, because in movies and in television, whenever you hear the word psychotic, violence is associated with it. And maybe if you can help us understand a little bit of the historical origins of this. I know that there's been a longstanding, you know, fear and mistreatment and persecution of people perceived as mad and as different, and who are acting different and weird in extreme states. And also, I know that there's a way in which the whole eugenics movement and connection feeds into this, with seeing people like myself or people who have extreme states as somehow not quite as human as the rest of us. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, this is a big subject, actually. Historically, people have feared the mad, quote the mad, right? People in strange states, that's true. And it may be physically, in the sense that they're, you know, they just don't seem reachable or whatever. And if you go a quick history lesson, so for example, in colonial days, they actually believed the mad had descended to the level of brutes by virtue of having lost their reason, and then should be treated as brutes. And so that might mean, so you see these very harsh medical therapeutics, everything from bleeding them aggressively. You can even read in medical textbooks of the need to whip them. This goes back to Europe, the whipping therapies. There was also therapies that were designed, they would spin people around real rapidly until they got sick. And actually, when you think about these therapies, what were they all doing, therapies? They were weakening the person, and they were making them, in that manner, they were making them sick and therefore less physically aggressive. So, you know, they were brutal, harsh, etc. But you can sort of see why they found them effective, is because they found them, it made people more manageable. And by the way, people so treated, so to speak, you know, feared these treatments, and maybe even the threat of the treatment could get them to behave somewhat.
So it's about punishing people and beating them down.
Well, yeah, and it's about managing them. That's right.
Yeah,
and
like wild animals. Like wild animals.
Manage I hate to say this, but you know, a misbehave, you know, a dog that you were afraid of, or something like that.
Doesn't the American Psychiatric Association, their seal, the APA seal, is an image of Benjamin Rush? Doesn't he have an interesting history?
Yeah, and you know, Rush is actually, he is. He's considered the father of American psychiatry. He's this, you know, he was at the Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia in the late 1700s. He actually is a mixed bag in terms of his therapeutics. What he's famous for, and this was the first American therapeutic that was adopted subsequently by European doctors, is what he called the tranquilizer chair. And the tranquilizer was this chair where he would, you know, straight-backed wooden chair with a hole where people could defecate and urinate. And he would strap them in there for hours, 4, 8, 12, 16, 32, 48 hours. And they would be strapped so tightly they couldn't move. Now, in addition, while they were strapped to the chair, he would bleed them aggressively. I mean, he'd take away a lot of blood. So the point that they lost so much blood, you know, it was lucky they could, you know, they didn't die. In addition, and now he thought that was, by the way, was a biological remedy for madness. He thought that Madness was caused by too much blood going to the brain. So if you bled someone, you were lessening blood flow to the brain. You were sort of balancing it.
Yeah, it's a chemical. And it's a chemical imbalance theory.
Absolutely, it was a
yeah.
blood imbalance.
Yeah.
And the chair, he said, restricted blood from going to the brain. So that helped reduce blood flow to the brain. And finally, he would pour ice water over the person's head, and that was supposed to reduce blood flow to the head as well. Now, we laugh at all that. It seems like torture, and in a way it was torture, and I'm sure it was experienced by the patients as torture. But you can be pretty sure that the patient, after being in that chair for 48 hours and bled and all that way, was docile because they were just too exhausted. And my guess is that when they were threatened with it again, they'd say, oh, God, I'll, you know, they might behave.
And I bet probably some of them, the earliest chance they got, tried to kill the people who had done it to them.
Maybe that as well. The only thing I would say then about Benjamin Rush is that, so he had this harsh therapeutics, and this was harsh therapeutics that came out of a medical belief that, like I said, people were psychotic, it descended to the level of animals and needed to be treated harshly. But there was he was also a Quaker. And at the same time, around the 1800s, Quakers in Europe are developing a reform movement that says, let's treat these people like brethren. Let's treat them kindly. Let's treat them in, let's build them a shelter. Let's feed them wine. Let's have nice bedrooms. So it was 180 degrees. And here goes to your question of violence, Will. When the first house opened in York, England, I think in 1792 or 96, I'm not quite sure. And in 1812, Samuel Tuke, who was one of the founders of this, writes up the results. And he says, you know, we don't get much violence at our place. It's almost non-existent. And he says, well, think about this. If you whip people and you treat them harshly and you treat them like brutes, what do you expect? Aren't they going to respond as brutes? But instead, what we do is we treat them kindly and we treat them as brethren, and we have virtually no problem with violence.
Yeah, and this is a principle it's kind of common sense. It's with managers and employees that if you treat the employee with respect and as if they're intelligent, they're going to respond. It's also been found with the movement to reduce the use of restraints and seclusion in mental hospitals, is that in number of places, especially in Pennsylvania, they've been able to dramatically reduce the need to restrain people and the need to put them in isolation rooms. And it's because they have a different attitude. They have a different climate. They don't treat people as if they're dangerous. They don't respond with violence. They respond in a different way. And as a result, the patients respond differently and you get less violence.
That's sort of the message that is contained today in moral therapy. The moral therapy was, and there's a great, Samuel Tuke was such a great writer, but that's what he's saying. If you hold up a mirror to people, and that mirror shows that says to that person, you're a respectable person, you can control your emotions, you can choose to behave well, and we're going to, you know, and we show empathy towards you, and we show that we like you. In other words, we give you all the good feedback that everybody else needs to feel good about themselves. And so he talks about if we treat you as a sane person, so often they'll choose to be sane and they'll act in a sane manner. And that's exactly what you see time and time again in these moral therapy institutes, is reports about how they didn't need to use restraints. Or you know, they might have a room, like basically the quiet room that someone would have to go to now and then. But and it makes sense, is because so often the violence, is what you're talking about, comes when people feel threatened, right? They feel like they're going to be thrown into restraints. And you know, they're frightened. And what do frightened creatures do? They lash back out.
And even the whole experience of being in a mental hospital, I mean, it's very similar to criminal justice system. I mean, you're confined. I mean, there are guards. There are people controlling you and watching over you. And so the very setting of a lot of these places itself can be provocative to people.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think, and now really we're getting into a second point. We started here with the beginning of we need to be aware of what role the drugs may play in stirring violence in a very physiological way. But then the second thing is we have to say, well, how does our manner of treating people perhaps stir violence? You know, what is the environment we create for treating people with psychotic episodes? And we have to think about that as well.
because these things just don't happen. I mean, I think sometimes the public image is that they exist out there, people who, quote, are mad exist out there in some sort of isolated world, right? And they have their madness, and for no reason at all, they lash out.
Right.
It's just some sort of bizarre evil or bizarre insanity, et cetera. And we just, because we don't want to, society doesn't want to take any responsibility for that violence, right?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say anytime someone is in an extreme state of consciousness or they're lashing out, they're violent, there's a context, there's a story, there's some, you know, it's maybe not be, maybe it's not a good reason, but there's some explanation of why the person got there. And one of the things I'm sure you noticed recently, I guess it was maybe two or three months ago, there was a prominent study released, which, again, common sense, researchers were again taking seriously the idea that people who end up with a schizophrenia diagnosis, a lot of them have experienced abuse as children. I know that's my experience. It completely ties in to what the kinds of states of consciousness that I've gotten into that ended up giving me a schizophrenia label. So when we talk about people who are become violent or who end up with a schizophrenia or psychosis diagnosis, we're often talking about people who are survivors of violence themselves.
Oh, the abuse connection with people diagnosed with schizophrenia is huge. And it's a guy, I know there's a guy in New Zealand, I think it's Reed, John Reed, who's doing some of this research. But for example, when you look at women who've been diagnosed with schizophrenia, the history of sexual abuse in their past is huge. It's a real high percentage. So, yeah, sure. I mean, I guess the point is people who've been abused are going to, they can become very frightened, obviously, I mean, among other things.
And this is also seen in research that's done on criminals, people who just are murderers or who are, who abuse their own children often. You know, usually there's a history of they themselves having experienced that violence.
Right. Here's where I think that this whole dialogue gets, this whole topic gets confusing, and maybe we should address it before this radio program ends. Because given all that, and I think society should take notice of all those factors, right? And certainly should take notice of all those factors when it tries to figure out to respond to someone in a societal way to who's committed violence, like, let's say, the murder of Wade Fenton. And here's where I think it gets confusing, because at least in my own mind, I still don't know how society can legally, exonerate someone who's committed violence. In other words, I think society should think about how are we treating people with psychosis, who've had psychotic episodes, or get so labeled, and we need to think about what role the drugs may be playing and what role the environment may be playing, but. And certainly we should be cognizant of abuse and all those things, but what happens when the legal system, I mean, do you hold people legally responsible or not?
So you're saying, like, for example, the insanity defense?
Well, I mean, yeah, okay, the insanity defense. Who isn't a little bit insane when they kill somebody?
That's my thinking. I mean, I think this whole issue leads us to the question of the criminal justice system in general. I mean, I would hope that anyone who commits an act of violence would be seen as desperate, extreme, and these are extreme things, and that in every case of violence, we would take a look at the context and the meaning and explore, you know, what is it that's going on, rather than the rush to judge, to punish, for vengeance, for portraying the perpetrator as evil, as different, as somehow not like us. I think that's when you really start to get into a very dangerous kind of scapegoating dynamic, where the reality is, if you were in exactly the same situation as that person, you might very well have done the same thing that they did. All of us have the capacity for extreme acts of violence, just as all of us have the capacity for madness.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. This is, I'm not quite as comfortable with this line of thinking. I guess what I'm saying, I guess, and I told you at the beginning of this, I have some real confusion on this topic in my own mind. And because on the other hand, I think you have to hold people responsible for their actions, right?
Right. No, that part I totally agree with, yeah.
And you
in truth, you can't have people going around killing people, you know, in you know, I mean, murder has to be a sanctioned act, and other acts of violence have to be sanctioned, and they have to be societal. Society has to sanction them, and they, in fact, I think they do have to punish them. That's, but this is why it gets so. Anyway, it's a confusing story, and I guess what I'm saying is, on the one, and I'm just talking individually. On the one hand, I see where these both where the drugs and societal treatment can stir violence, right? And that can lead, for me personally, to have an instinct of forgiveness for those people, for someone who commits an act of violence, all right? On the other hand, I have this feeling that you just can't allow violent acts. You know, the people have to be personally responsible. And it's almost like a contradiction in terms, but I do have that feeling is that somehow you still nevertheless need to hold people personally responsible. That's why I think the whole issue is, for me, so, you know, difficult.
Yeah, I think it is a difficult issue. I think that what we're seeing is the failure of the criminal justice system as it exists now to really help people or even contribute to change, because I mean there is such a focus on vengeance and punishment, and I think that the question is, how do you hold people accountable? How do you have a response? How do you sanction people? How do you, you know, say no to this behavior, and at the same time bring in a larger, broader understanding? I mean, it's a huge topic. I mean, one of the things that I'm interested in is the restorative justice movement, which is an effort to see community restitution and some kind of relationship that victims of violence can actually have better, a feeling of closure if the perpetrator isn't just necessarily locked away forever, but that there's some kind of restitution, there's some kind of relationship, there's some kind of encounter that happens, and some kind of community response, rather than just seeing it in terms of simply a punishment paradigm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly is self-defeating to put people in jail, isolate them, and basically say you'll never be allowed back into society in any sort of full way, you know, I mean, like with voting rights, and, you know, the whole thing.
Right.
So, and I think you're right, that sort of restitution makes sense. You've harmed society, and but it can be sort of, it can help people change. I mean, if we believe in people changing, and we believe that someone can commit a criminal act and yet, you know, reform his or her ways, then you need to have a system that helps people do that. And all you got to do is look at our jails. Something's not right, right? I mean, we imprison more people than any other society.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look at Western Europe. Their imprisonment rates are a fraction of ours.
Well,
and it's not like they're more violent societies, so obviously something we're doing isn't working.
Right, exactly. And the societies that have, it seems like the societies that have less inequality, that there's more social equality, there's less violence and less crime.
I think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, it raises a lot of questions, and I think it's interesting to look at it from a historical standpoint, because hasn't there been a push in psychiatry and in the eugenics movement to see criminality as itself a kind of a human defect, and that you have criminal brains and these are different people, and we have
right.
to get these out of the gene pool of our race and create a more superior, virtuous race through genetic control and manipulation.
Right. And you do see this real strongly in the history of psychiatry. And broadly speaking, you can sort of chart sort of four eras in the history of psychiatry in the United States. There's sort of the early days when we had these sort of very harsh medical therapeutics, when they thought people who were mad had descended to the level of animals. Then we get this period of moral therapy that's really influenced by Quakers in the sense that, oh no, they're brethren. And then we do, towards the end of the 1800s, fall under the sway of eugenics. And eugenics is this belief that people have, you know, are defectives. They're genetically defective, and that might be whether they're that makes them a criminal, or it may make them, you know, mentally ill. the eugenic idea was that insanity was handed down in the same way of blue eyes, that it was a recessive disorder. Therefore, if you had the normal gene from your mom and the insane gene from your father, you weren't insane, but you were a carrier. And then if your kid got both the insane genes, they would be doomed to be insane. And you're right. This happens in the early part of the 20th century. And the same idea was with criminals. Some people are basically born to be criminals. Society doesn't make them. It's in their genetic makeup. And really, it was that those eugenic beliefs that led up to Nazi Germany in this whole sense that some people are, useless eaters and need to be eliminated, and therefore we can only have the good genes in our society and have a better race. Now, eugenics became a shame science, of course, at the end of World War II and at the end of the Holocaust, with the acknowledgement of the awareness of the Holocaust. But those sort of eugenic attitudes that some people are sort of just by race or by nature more violent prone or a little bit defective, you know, that really hasn't totally gone away. And it's sort of that idea is lurking, I think, in the back of our minds often.
Do you think that that expresses itself in the idea of, you know, schizophrenia or paranoid schizophrenia is a genetic biological brain disorder? People who have paranoid schizophrenia are more likely to be violent, and therefore violence in society has some kind of genetic origin, and we need to, you know, figure out how to screen people. Right. Like already there are, when I have a friend who's pregnant, I'm close to her, and I've been hearing about all of the things that she's been going through, and there's genetic screenings now. They're taking a look at fetuses before they're born,
right,
to determine, and I think in a lot of ways, you know, it's a very positive thing, because there are terrible diseases that are clearly genetic and they're absolutely clear-cut cases, and then that might be a situation where, okay, this is, you may not want to have a child that's got this genetic future. But with something like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia,
right,
when they can't even define what schizophrenia is,
right,
I mean, it's to think about the direction. But I think that, do you think that that's where we're headed potentially if this kind of thinking continues?
Well, first of all, the roots of that thinking, you know, do go back to the eugenicists. I mean, some of the research done supposedly proving that there's a genetic basis to schizophrenia. And by the way, there may be some genetic vulnerability to it, some sort of vulnerability that makes you less able to handle stress, for example, something like that. But the sort of genetic determinism, that schizophrenia is genetically determined, basically.
Right,
some
because
of that research
the,
goes back to Nazi Germany.
Yeah, I mean, because I hear this, you know, the vulnerability or the predisposition, but, you know, your predisposition to be, you know, less tolerant of stress, that could be a positive thing. I mean, that can make you a very sensitive, creative, artistic
right.
person, or maybe a powerful scientist who is very dedicated to looking at the details of their research. The end result of being mentally ill seems very much a question of society and society's factors and definitions and responses to the person. And I don't think there's ever going to be any kind of causal genetic, if you have this gene, you're going to have bipolar disorder, in the way that we can say, if you have this gene, you're going to have Down syndrome. If you have
right.
this gene, you're going to have a certain kind of disease, like some diseases you can.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you asked me, do I think we're headed in that direction? And I think the answer is yes. More genetic screenings and more screenings where you're practically saying someone might have a predisposition to something or an extra risk of, like, developing bipolar or something like that. Listen, I mean, once you start doing that, you're starting to narrow down the possibilities of sort of human mind that you consider acceptable. Because clearly, if you go back through history, people who today would be labeled bipolar are some of the most, you know, accomplished people, whether it be in arts or science or wherever it might be. You know, I mean, was William Blake mad? I mean, I probably. So the point is, when you start defining mental characteristics, some sort of propensity to whether it be bipolar or what you want to call it, ADHD, where you're supposedly easily distracted, or even some of the vulnerability to psychosis, whatever that might be. I mean, first of all, schizophrenia is a term that covers a lot of symptoms. You know, that's a really bad thing to be.
screening for in your in utero with any thought of weeding, quote, those genetic strains out. I mean, I'm afraid that we might be going that way, but that is a really awful eugenic idea.
Yeah, you're weeding out traits that you assume might probably be bad if, you know, if they aren't maybe good, if the person doesn't get lucky.
Right, it's just so ridiculous. I mean,
well, it's the genetic, it's the eugenics dream of perfecting the species, really.
Yeah, but what's perfect?
Yeah.
I mean, what's normal?
Who defines perfect?
I mean, obviously, human society is supposed to be diverse, right?
Exactly.
We're not all supposed to be the same. Well, and nature wouldn't make us the same because obviously a society is healthier when it has a spectrum of human beings.
Exactly. Well, if you take a parallel from agriculture, I mean, the way in which agricultural crops have been monocropped and you get the exact same genetic strain of corn, it wreaks havoc ecologically. Environments and ecologies don't like that kind of uniformity. And so you get much greater vulnerability to pests, you get much greater vulnerability to disease, and then you find out that, lo and behold, your advanced strain of corn is needing a lot more attention in the future to prevent it to able to continue to be productive, whereas the traditional agricultural methods that have been used for thousands of years that are based on diversity and putting a lot of different crops and all kinds of genetic diversity and genetic differences have a much more robust ability to survive.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a clear lesson from nature and a clear lesson why you wouldn't want to be doing it to humans. You want the genetic diversity.
Exactly. And there's always so much more to talk about. Bob, we're out of time. It's been really great having you on this show talking about a very difficult and challenging topic. Is there any, we have maybe a couple more minutes. Is there anything you wanted to add or you want to just give us a little sneak preview of the book that you're working on now?
I guess stay on topic now for the second. I don't think there are easy answers on this question. And I'm talking about now going back to the original subject of violence and madness and what you do in response. But I do think we owe it to ourselves and to anybody who is so, labeled to be honest about what the drugs may do, what role the environment may do. And so then when we fashion a response, rather than just the knee-jerk, oh, let's keep them drugged up. And by the way, if you keep them so drugged up they can't move, I suppose that will work. Anyway, we owe it to... The ethical response is to be honest and is to talk about these other factors and then hopefully we could come to some sort of, you know, wise solution. Unfortunately, other than radical radio shows like yourself, it's just not discussed. And anyway, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, thank you for being willing to air it, and hopefully it'll get more of an airing.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Bob Whitaker.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me, Will.
You've been listening to Robert Whitaker. He's the author of Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill. You're listening to WXOJ LPFM, Valley Free Radio. This is the Radical Mental Health Show, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Thanks a lot for tuning in.